Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. On August 29, 2005, a Category 5 hurricane hit Louisiana and left a devastating trail in its path. The levees collapse swamped 80% of New Orleans with polluted water up to 20 feet deep. Hurricane Katrina killed more than 1,800 people and displaced more than a million. 10 years after the disaster, New Orleans has gone through major changes. 100,000 of the city's black residents have not returned. The city has a white mayor, a white supermajority in the city council, and white leaders run the police department, public housing, and schools. So what is the state of recovery policies in New Orleans and other affected regions? What's happened to the city's low-income black population who were devastated by the flooding and lack of support in the immediate aftermath of the storm? When today's guest, investigative journalist Gary Rivlin, went to New Orleans just days after the levees broke, he knew that the floodwaters would eventually recede, and he wanted to find out how New Orleans would go about the complicated task of rebuilding. In his new book, Katrina, After the Flood, Gary Rivlin takes an in-depth look at the evolution of the city and the beneficiaries of billions of dollars of federal government reconstruction and relief fund. Gary Rivlin is a former New York Times reporter, an investigative fellow at the Nation Institute, and author of four previous books. His latest is Katrina, After the Flood. And Gary joins us from the studios of the Radio Foundation in New York. Hi, Gary. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, Rose. Great to be here.
Great to have you. So I want to start off by talking about a little bit of history, because I was sort of shocked to watch a lot of TV coverage over the last couple of days. And of course, Katrina got so much attention. And I would say the overwhelming percentage of guests on the shows called it a natural disaster. And when I heard that, I immediately thought of Harry Shearer's documentary, The Big Uneasy, which relied on expert witnesses, some whistleblowers, who detailed the main claim that this was a natural disaster. And, you know, the Army Corps of Engineers got a lot of the blame in his piece. And the documentary basically said, no, this was definitely not a natural disaster. What is your take on that? And what was your reaction when you heard people say it was a natural disaster?
Right. But by this point, after 10 years, I flinch every time I hear somebody say natural disaster. I mean, in fairness, it comes out naturally. If you're looking at the Mississippi Gulf Coast, they were hit by, in quotes, a natural disaster. It's interesting because Katrina was a Category 5 over the Gulf of Mexico, lost a little bit of steam and jogged east just before hitting New Orleans. And so the Gulf Coast was devastated by a hurricane. 26-27 foot storm surge hit the Gulf Coast, Gulfport, Biloxi, what's sarcastically referred to as the Redneck Riviera, and just wiped away blocks and blocks and blocks of homes right off the ocean. But in New Orleans, Katrina was actually a weak Category 3, if not a Category 2, by the time it hit New Orleans. The levee system was supposed to be built to withstand a Category 3 storm, and it did not. You know, it's within an hour or two, it started to crumble. 350-mile flood protection system, about half of it, failed. Groups of scientists came in. Team Louisiana was a group of scientists from Louisiana. There was a UC Berkeley-led team that came in. The Corps itself investigated. All three, including the Corps, concluded that it was the fault of human beings, that the levee system, they didn't dig deep down enough. They built some of it on sand, which meant it collapsed too easily. A professor at UC Berkeley called it the worst engineering disaster since Chernobyl.
Hmm. Well, I was reading an old interview with Harry Shearer when he made this documentary, and he said his head exploded when he was watching President Obama's town hall meeting in New Orleans, when he basically said in passing that the flood was a natural disaster. And he said it's really hard to get to the bottom of the truth, the bottom of the story, but you have to dig. That is the reporter's job, is to dig, to find out what really happened.
Right. And, you know, I mean, the truth is, within a year, there was no ambiguity. I mean, the Corps took responsibility. The head of the Corps at the time, who would end up stepping down a month or so later, said it was our fault. We did not build it to specifications. We failed. In fact, there was a piece of the system that wasn't even completed. There was actually a hole. There was a place where water just poured through because there wasn't a wall there. They never finished it. It was started in the mid 1960s. The good news for New Orleans now is they have a host of problems there, but the flood protection system is not one of them. We spent federal taxpayers, all of us taxpayers, spent about $15 billion rebuilding a system that's much, much sturdier than it had been before. The Harry Shearers of the world wish it was an even stronger system. It's still rated just for a Category 3. Of course, there could be a Category 4 or the worst, a Category 5. But even so, the fear isn't that the walls will collapse like they did after Katrina, but that they'll be over top. So even in the worst case scenario, there'll be water in New Orleans, but it won't be deluge like it was, because presumably, or the experts agree, both locally and nationally, that this system will withstand the storm surge. With one big asterisk on it, assuming the southern Louisiana does something about the coastal wetlands, the wetlands in southern Louisiana, they're losing like 25 to 30 square miles every year of the coastal wetlands, and there's no better buffer against storm surge than the wetlands. For every 3 miles of wetlands that storm surge hits, you lose a foot. And they've lost about 50 miles worth of wetlands since like the 1930s.
So we have to really keep an eye on how federal officials are going to work to stop the erosion of coastal wetlands at this point.
Well, you know, it's the state implemented a few years ago, or announced is probably a better word, a $50 billion 50-year program to deal with coastal restoration and to stop the loss of wetlands. And it's a very ambitious program. It's a very thoughtful program. The problem is that they only have a bit of the funding, roughly 10, 15 billion of the 50 billion. So that's the question. There's a plan, they understand, but will there be the money and the will to actually implement it?
So, Gary, you were working for the New York Times when the flood happened. You arrived just a couple days after the levees broke, and everybody was talking, as they should have, about why this happened and why the government did such a bad job of taking care of its own people. But you knew that the floodwaters would eventually recede, and you really wanted to find out how New Orleans would go about the complicated task of rebuilding. What was going through your mind at that point?
So just to back up one bit for the San Francisco angle on this, I was actually in the San Francisco bureau of the New York Times when Katrina happened, covering Silicon Valley, probably on my 46th Google story, and you know, Hewlett Packard is restructuring under Carly Fiorina was one of the stories I was working on that summer. But you know, I'm not even sure why that. Everyone around me, fellow reporters, the scientists, they're looking at a host of interesting issues. Why the levees failed, why a tragedy unfolded in front of us, a slow-moving tragedy. I'll remind people that after the city flooded, it was on a Monday morning. It wasn't until Friday morning, day five, when finally buses started arriving en masse to save people who were trapped in the Superdome, where there were 25,000 people, no electricity, they're out of water, they're out of food, they're out of medical supplies. There were another 20,000 at the convention center. Again, no food, no water, no supplies. The convention center wasn't even meant to be used. The police had to break in and just give people a dry place to be. It wasn't until Saturday, day six, that the buses started to arrive en masse. It wasn't until Sunday, day seven, when the convention center was finally cleared. And, you know, let's a little bit about geography of New Orleans. It's right on the Mississippi River. The convention center is basically borders the Mississippi River. Why weren't there boats? Why weren't there naval ships? Starting Monday night, the governor of Louisiana, Kathleen Blanco at the time, was begging for buses. Please, 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 we need it. Tuesday, Wednesday, FEMA's promising the buses. They didn't show up till Friday. It really was gross incompetence. There's anyone looking back on it just where was FEMA? What were they doing? A year before Katrina, there was an exercise called Hurricane Pam. Believe it or not, the federal government spent almost $1 million to anticipate a slow-moving Category 3 storm hitting New Orleans. What might happen? Well, Katrina was a slow-moving Category 3 storm that hit New Orleans. In Hurricane Pam, this exercise, which involved local officials, federal officials, they ended up concluding, like, wow, this could really drown much of the city. There could be as much as 100,000 people trapped there. We need X number of trucks of water, X number of trucks of food. We need the buses, and we need to have them right on the outskirts of the storm so they'll be ready once the storm winds die down to come in. Everybody knew exactly what needed to be done. There was talk of doing it. It just never was done. There wasn't enough water, not enough food, and the buses took days and days to show.
Hmm. Now, you ended up staying for 8 months in New Orleans, and I've read that you had to leave because of mold, and your body just couldn't deal with the mold.
I had no idea I was allergic to mold before I showed up in New Orleans, but, you know, you go to places that sat in water for weeks and weeks and weeks, you learn the hard way. I took a couple of shots of cortisone, hung on as long as I could, but I had to give up. But, of course, I never gave up. But New Orleans, there's people in the book who I've been in contact with, talking to regularly since 10, 11 days after the storm.
And I brought that up because some people who are living in New Orleans still are dealing with the mold. AJ Plus, Al Jazeera Plus, has these great video series, and they interviewed a woman who has a hard time actually going inside of her house because it's still covered in mold.
Yeah, I call it the Katrina cough. I mean, I show up and 3 or 4 days later, I've got this little cough, this little tickle. And it is amazing how many people are suffering some sense. Of course, it's not a moldy city anymore. Most every home has been at least gutted and cleaned out. But maybe the most amazing thing is there are still homes that are just sitting there 10 years later, just bashed in. Doesn't seem like they've been touched in 10 years.
You have stories in your book about people who are surviving. I mean, such a wide range of people. You paint a really interesting picture of the Lower Ninth Ward that got a lot of media attention. Tell us what it looks like today. I mean, 4 months after Katrina hit, you write about the fact that in the Lower Ninth Ward, there were still soldiers with rifles. It was the last place to get gas, water, trailers. There's still a lack of business there. And tell us about this guy you interviewed, Henry Irvin, who had flood insurance, but he's pretty much living alone in his neighborhood. He rebuilt around 2008, but he still has no neighbors.
Right. So, I mean, the tragedy of the Lower Ninth Ward is that it was a self-fulfilling prophecy. 2 weeks after Katrina, Ray Nagin, then the mayor, was quoted as saying, oh, we can't rebuild the Lower Ninth Ward. It's the lowest lying part of New Orleans. It's not. It's unfortunate that its name implies it is, but in the 1920s, the Army Corps of Engineers built a canal through the Ninth Ward, breaking into the upper and lower Ninth Wards. It has nothing to do with elevation. It's just the southern part of the Ninth Ward. And so it became this sense of like, oh, it's the lowest lying place. Well, Lakeview, a white prosperous community, it's lower lying. New Orleans East, a black prosperous community, it's lower lying than the Lower Ninth Ward. Yet, it was the last for everything, as you point out, the last to get FEMA trailers. It took almost a year for FEMA trailers to show up there. They didn't want to build a school there. They didn't want to rebuild any of the five schools there, because why bother? Because they weren't going to rebuild it. So this place that there wasn't much money anyway, very working class neighborhood, it just was last for everything, and it just played out over the next bunch of years. So you could go to parts of the Lower Ninth Ward now and drive two or three blocks and not see a single home. It'll wow. Just where blocks where there used to be homes, there's just occasional slab, occasionally bashed in home, but mainly just overgrown lots with weeds. So Henry Irvin, who, yeah, I think it was 09, but 6-7 years ago, rebuilt. He had been a supervisor at a plant. He, you know, had a pretty good job. So he had a little bit of savings. He had the money to afford flood insurance. So he rebuilt, and he literally has no neighbors for two blocks going one way. His only neighbor on his block is a church. You can go 3 or 4 blocks in almost every direction, and there's only a single block where there's a few people living. Home alone is exactly the image I have for him.
I'm speaking with investigative journalist Gary Rivlin about his new book, Katrina, After the Flood. Gary takes an in-depth look at the evolution of New Orleans and the beneficiaries of billions of dollars of federal government relief and reconstruction action. We'll talk in a bit about the Road Home Program, the largest federal housing recovery program in history, $10 billion. And if you'd like to join us 10 years after Katrina, what questions do you have about rebuilding efforts? What really struck you in the media coverage that you've seen and heard over the past couple of days? What struck me is that most of the politicians who went on television said, we're resilient, we're back, we've never been stronger. They didn't mention the fact that 10 years later, 100,000 of the city's black residents are not back. They haven't returned. So what questions do you have for Gary about Katrina? If you have lived in Louisiana or Mississippi, any of the areas that have been affected, if you have family there, how are they coping? And the other thing is, if you know anyone who was sent to other states, I was in Salt Lake City, Utah when this happened and interviewed people who were there who thought they were going to Texas. So we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. So what about the narrative that politicians are pushing right now, Gary, that New Orleans is resilient, we've never been stronger, we are back? I mean, this is the message that I heard on TV over the past couple days, but I did not hear any of these politicians say that 100,000 of the city's black residents have not returned.
Right, in a city that was 450,000 at the time of Katrina. So the resiliency rap, I mean, I get it. I was living in New Orleans in those early months, and there really was a prospect that much of the city might not be rebuilt back then. Half the city is under sea level. There was a real big push, especially in Washington, D.C., like, why should we give them all this money if they're just going to rebuild and be back in harm's way? You had Dennis Hastert at the time, the Speaker of the House, saying, I think we should bulldoze most of that place. And so there are very powerful forces in D.C. that were against the rebuilding of New Orleans. Locally, there was a public debate that went on for months debating the wisdom of rebuilding the lowest-lying parts of the city. So the fact that the city came back, that many of the neighborhoods are doing well and thriving, the fact that the center of town, you know, the central business district, the economy is doing well, is something of a miracle. But I call it the half the New Orleans miracle. So it's not that it bothers me what people are saying or were saying when talking about New Orleans on the Sunday news shows, whatever. It's just it was half the story. What about the other half of the story? Because if you go to the eastern half of the city, which is to say the largely African-American part of the city, there's still a lot of suffering. I talked to a guy who said, they got rid of the water, but I'm still drowning here. Mm-hmm. You go, I mean, you mentioned low income, but you go to New Orleans East, which I mentioned before, a black middle class, professional class community that actually has some very wealthy subdivisions there. It's only about 80% back 10 years after Katrina. You look at Pontchartrain Park, a historic black middle class neighborhood, the first subdevelopment in the state of Louisiana that allowed black home ownership. This was in the 1950s. It's maybe two-thirds back 10 years after Katrina. And you contrast that with Lakeview, a prosperous white community, and it's 100% back 10 years after Katrina. So there's still a lot of suffering. It was not an equal opportunity storm. You're more than three times more likely to lose a home if you're a black homeowner in New Orleans and if you're a white homeowner. And it has not been an equal opportunity recovery, and there's policy reasons for that. It's just not just happenstance. There was a deliberate effort to try to have less low-income people come back to New Orleans.
And you write about this in your book. You write about white officials in New Orleans saying publicly, this is our chance to change this city demographically and politically. I mean, people openly talked about this.
Right. So this was a city that was 68% black and black run at the time of Katrina. The white uptown set, those who go back generations, they're still running the business part of town, the philanthropic, you know, community part of town. But they didn't have control of the political apparatus. And they saw Katrina as their opportunity. And in fact, there was open talk of it. And in fact, as you pointed out in the introduction, within 5 years, it was first white mayor in 32 years, white supermajority, white police chief, white prosecutor, white-controlled school board, white-controlled public housing. I mean, it really was something of a coup in no small part, because there was less African Americans in the city. That's changed a little bit. It's still a white mayor, but it's back to a black majority in the council. It's still a black white prosecutor. Whites still run the schools, but now there's a black police chief. So it's changed a little bit in the last few years. But there really was a sense that this was a deliberate plan, and those behind it got their way.
You've also said that there's palpable anger happening, and you can see it in the polls, that 80% of whites say New Orleans has recovered, whereas only 40% of blacks say the city has recovered.
Right. And yeah, so just to go back to this time, we're talking about those well-off blue bloods who are openly talking about re-seizing control of New Orleans. But, you know, then there were policies. And, you know, it was an African-American mayor at the time, Ray Nagin. So public housing, some of public housing was flooded, but much of it wasn't. It never reopened. All of it, every last bit of the big four housing units, as they call them in New Orleans, were covered by fence and razor wire and never reopened. They were knocked down. They're now mixed income. And so there's a waiting list of 18,000 people now for public housing or Section 8 vouchers. And they closed the list in 2012. And so they figured there'd probably be about 50,000 if they hadn't closed the list. So that's one piece where it was clear that there was a way, like, how can we thwart lower-income people from coming back? And let's remember that a large percentage of those were the working poor. This is a city that's largely a tourist economy. And so you've got the kitchen help, the chambermaids in the big hotels. These are people getting by on $15,000, $20,000 a year. That was a lot of who was living in public housing prior to Katrina.
And Gary, I've seen videos of all of these new coffee shops and cupcake shops and chocolate shops. Who's getting those jobs?
Well, you know, it's they call them the YURPS, the Young Urban Recovery Professionals. So after Katrina, there's a lot of amazing effort by volunteers from outsiders, college kids, faith-based organizations, just people just showing up to help with gutting, help any way they could. And just a lot of people were really turned on to New Orleans as a place to be. I mean, the culture, the history, it's a relatively inexpensive place to live relative to a San Francisco Bay Area or Brooklyn, where have you. And so, you know, there's a real young energy there. And in fact, there are from cupcake shops, but, you know, just what we see going on in gentrified neighborhoods around the country. In fact, it's interesting. There's 20% less people living in New Orleans, but there's more restaurants than ever. But people who are working there at these places for minimum wage, it's now the poverty's in the suburbs. You know, they're living two or three families to a house. I mean, it's the kind of stuff we've seen go on in the San Francisco Bay Area. As prices there have soared, as, you know, San Francisco becomes a prohibitively expensive place for people. People moving further out, people are really struggling.
What about the income of working class and poor people? How have their incomes changed since Katrina?
This is just a startling statistic. In the year 2000, median black income in New Orleans was $30,000. Whites, it was 48. I'm not 100% sure of that number, but high 40s. By 2013, median black income in New Orleans was $25,000, adjusting for inflation. In other words, less. Whereas median white income was up at $60,000. It had gone up roughly 20%. And so what we see happening in New Orleans, in no small part because of the policies implemented after Katrina, is that it has the second highest wealth gap of any city in this country, and it's going in the wrong direction. The wealth gap is getting wider in New Orleans. It's not closing.
Investigative journalist Gary Rivlin is joining us to talk about his new book, Katrina, After the Flood. He went to New Orleans just days after the levees broke, and he knew that the floodwaters would recede, so he wanted to find out how New Orleans would go about the complicated task of rebuilding. Today, 10 years later, 100,000 of the city's black residents have not returned, and parts of black New Orleans have still not recovered. If you have any questions or comments, we'd love to hear from you. What are your thoughts about the media coverage? If you have connections to any place that was affected by the Gulf, give us a call. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. We'll be back after this.
This is your call on local public radio. To join in today's conversation, the toll-free number, 866-798-8255, 866-798-TALK. If you prefer to write your note rather than send us and call us, the email address is feedback@yourcallradio.org. Coming up at 11 o'clock from the BBC, World Have Your Say. Following that at 12 noon, John Perry and Ken Taylor and Philosophy Talk.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we'll have a conversation about what the Tenderloin looks like through the eyes of kids who live there. Equipped with cameras, 19 young people used photography to explore poverty, immigration, and public health. The Tenderloin has a reputation for homelessness, drugs, and now an increasing number of tech companies. So what do these images tell us about life in the Tenderloin and a changing San Francisco? If you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today I'm joined by investigative journalist Gary Rivlin, who is out with a new book, Katrina, After the Flood. Gary wanted to find out how New Orleans would go about the complicated task of rebuilding once the flood waters receded. Gary's a former New York Times reporter and investigative fellow at the Nation Institute. And we've got a number of calls, so let's hear from Denny in Richmond. Hi, Denny. Welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for the show. Very, very timely, obviously. I wonder if I could get your guests' comments on the remarkable work that musicians played in bringing back the spirit to New Orleans during that difficult time period, particularly from the radio station WWOZ, who had to obviously relocate and find a way to broadcast from Baton Rouge. They recently produced a documentary, which I can recommend to you, everybody, about how this station and the musicians in New Orleans really were, you know, leading the effort to restore it. And also, I just want to second everything you've been saying about how the racist plan to rid New Orleans of poor people of color was real. It's very real, and that doesn't get talked about enough. So thank you so much for talking about that.
Thank you. Gary?
Yeah, so, you know, I mean, I have not seen the documentary. Now I want to, but, I mean, the caller gets at something. There were miracles everywhere. I mean, all these different communities, whether it was the musicians, which of course are critical to the future of New Orleans, outsiders coming and saying, like, hey, how can we help? We could donate instruments. There was creation of housing for musicians. I mean, you can imagine after Katrina, 80% of the city is covered in water, 110,000 homes, renters. There was a lack of affordable housing there. And so people said, okay, we need the music. We need to have the core of this place come back. Food, music, culture is so essential to New Orleans. And so there was a real effort to make sure that the musicians could come back. And, you know, I mean, that's some of the positive of this story. The cultural scene, to my eye, is really thriving in New Orleans. Again, the center of town, the tourist part of town, the part of town along the river, which is more prosperous, the higher ground, really is thriving. And whether we're talking about the music, the food, the second lines, you know, just basically impromptu music that just happens in New Orleans. It's almost like it's in the air and all. That's back, and that's really wonderful. There's concern long-term if there's 100,000 fewer African-Americans over time, will there be a different city? But right now, it seems to me that, you know, that core is there in part because of the efforts of outsiders and the resiliency, the effort of the locals who made sure to come back so New Orleans would remain New Orleans culturally.
And Gary, do we know, you know, who actually left? When we're talking about 100,000 people, I mentioned that I was in Salt Lake City, Utah when this happened and was shocked to interview probably about 50, mostly blacks, maybe 5 whites, who were put on a plane from New Orleans, told they were going to Houston, Texas. But once they were airborne, they said, actually, we're taking you to Salt Lake City, Utah. And they were living in army barracks.
Yeah, that's fairly typical. A lot of people were told nothing. It really angered people that families were split up. You're getting on this bus or plane. You're getting on that one, which of course invoked very historic, you know, uncomfortable feelings. Mm. And so it's that's a typical story. You're asking who it is.
Is anyone keeping track?
No. Hmm. You know, I've seen numbers. So Houston is, in fact, where the greatest concentration of former New Orleanians are. In fact, there's a group there. They call themselves the Houston Orleanians. They refuse, even if they own a home there, they refuse to call Houston home. They live in Houston. They reside in Houston, but New Orleans in their head is home. But even there, I've seen numbers as wide as 20,000 folks to 50,000. No one was really paying attention. It was a disaster. People were just thrown to the wind. And, you know, you get a one-way ticket from FEMA. It's not a round trip ticket, and there was never a plan. There's never a way to help people come back home. I mean, lots of middle class people, they just take out their credit card, fly home, put down the first and last month deposit on a rental unit, and start rebuilding their life. But we're talking about a large portion of the population that did not have the money. In fact, an interesting poll taken, I don't know, 6 months after Katrina, of those who ended up in Houston. 68% of them had a job when Katrina hit, but they were low-income people. They were the working poor. But they weren't – I think in some people's mind, like, oh, well, these are people who didn't have a job anyway. Well, they had a job. They just weren't paid very much money. And you're living on $15,000 a year. You're perched in Houston. Life is very expensive. How are you going to get those extra few thousand dollars you need to muster to get yourself back to New Orleans? Some people found a better life. I mean, some people – their kids ended up in better schools. There's a character in my book that, you know, his – He had eight kids. You know, only one was back because the others found a job somewhere else. Their kids were doing better in school. If you're older, there's a better healthcare system as opposed to New Orleans, where 2-3 years after Katrina, half the hospitals weren't open yet. Many of the doctors were still missing. So people found a reason. What I think is insidious is that those who wanted to get back, there was no help, and in fact, there were stumbling blocks put in their way to make it harder for them to get back.
Gary Rivlin is an investigative journalist. We're talking about his new book, Katrina After the Flood. He takes an in-depth look at the evolution of New Orleans and interviews a wide range of people, from politicians to people who are trying to rebuild. And now I would like to welcome Tabitha Mustafa to the show. Tabitha is a native New Orleanian and an active part of the city's social justice community. She works with the group Peace by Peace. It's a program of the American Friends Service Committee. And Tabitha joins us from New Orleans. Hi, Tabitha. Tabitha, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Well, it's great to have you. In 2005, you were only 13 years old. So talk a little bit about what you remember about 10 years ago, and how are you and your friends and family reflecting?
10 years ago, one of the most fond memories I have is arguing with my mom about whether or not we were going to leave. They hadn't issued the mandatory evacuation yet, and my grandmother was in a nursing home at the time. So I went ahead and packed a bag for me. I packed a bag for my mom. I packed all the dog's things, and I was ready to go, even though she said we weren't leaving unless my grandmother's nursing home would be evacuated. Eventually, they issued a mandatory evacuation, which meant that the nursing home would be leaving, too. It was probably about 4 or 5 in the afternoon on that Sunday that we got on the road, and it took us about 12 hours to get about 6 hours away in Mississippi. And,
wow.
One of the most fond memories is our cars just sitting on a road for miles and miles and miles, and I think that's an image that is probably burned into a lot of people who had the ability to evacuate, burned into our memories.
And you grew up with all of this. I mean, you were 13 when it happened, and we've been talking with Gary about the changes that have happened in the last 10 years, where, you know, 100,000 of the city's black residents have not returned. Within 5 years, the city had a white mayor, a white supermajority, white leaders running the police department, public housing, and schools. What were the conversations you had in high school and college about just how you all were affected by the storm? I mean, was it with you throughout the... I mean, was it like a major part of your life in school and what you were talking about?
Yeah, I mean, if you want to start that year, I think that one of the worst things was having to be called a refugee throughout school and returning to school. And some of my friends weren't able to return to school, to return to the city. Education has been a topic of conversation since that year. My mom was a public school teacher, and she got fired, you know, just not long after the storm. She had been teaching for over 20 years, almost 25 years, actually. And so that really hit home, and it's been a conversation, especially here at Piece by Piece, with the youth that I work with, because they feel like they've actually experienced prison and not an education system. So, like, two very different systems kind of being integrated into one system. It's one of the only places in the country with a pretty much all charter public school system. I don't know how you can use the word charter, which is usually implies that it's a privatized institution, and call it a public school. It usually serves private interests. You see Capital One, you see different banks and organizations' names outside of the school, and then they're hiring these fresh out of college, predominantly white, not from New Orleans, Teach for America teachers, in a system that had about 7,500 black middle-class employees who were from the city, who understood the culture and all of the nuances and intricacies of being a student in New Orleans, which is much more than just taking tests, which seems to be difficult for, you know, people who run KIPP and different charter organizations to understand. You have to imagine that closing all or most of the city's traditional public schools that were named after admirable black people, say like Benjamin Banneker, a scientist and astronomer, and the name has been changed to KIPP, which is the name of a charter foundation. So just kind of removing these connections to black history, I think, has been part of the narrative of kind of removing blackness from New Orleans.
And Gary, what about that? It was shocking to learn that 7,500 public school teachers were fired in 2006.
2005.
2005.
It was within 2 months.
What's
really
wow.
interesting, if not shocking, about this is that so St. Bernard Parish, the neighboring parish just south and east of Orleans Parish, they were 100% flooded. They didn't fire their teachers en masse. It was only Orleans Parish that fired every last teacher and did not give them the right of returning to the job. In fact, there was a lawsuit that the teachers filed, and they won in lower courts. They won in the appellate court, but there was no money. It's like, hey, you mistreat us. Well, okay, we're going to award you $1 billion, but no one has the money to pay them. I mean, something Tabitha said that's so interesting. It's like, now let's remember, these are people who are displaced. They're living perched wherever they are for months at a time, maybe a couple of years. They want to come back. And what's home? I mean, home is the house that, you know, if you were fortunate enough to rebuild. But your school, suddenly there were no neighborhood schools. So there's this chaotic system where you had all these traumatized kids. There's one stat I saw. There's a new book out about the children of Katrina by Laurie Peake and Alice Fothergill, two sociologists, that the average school-age child affected by Katrina moved 7.2 times, plus times. After Katrina. And so they come back. What do you want? What do you want? You want home. And, you know, so you want to go back to that school where your brother went or where you were going when Katrina hit. But instead, it was just chaos. And, you know, adding on top of that, not only were these new schools, they're opening, they're closing. You pick a school, you go through the trauma of having to figure out which school X miles away you're going to go to. But it was amazing how much these schools are opening and then 2 or 3 years later closing. They're failing. The school is closing them. Last point, too, is that, you know, this idea of a disaster as an opportunity. So just prior to Katrina, the governor, Kathleen Blanco, a moderate Democrat, had been trying to take over more of the public schools in New Orleans. Their grades were low. Their test scores, I mean, were low. And she was pushing to do that. She had taken over 2 or 3. But then Katrina happened. Within 2 months, they had taken over virtually every public school in the system. And this is where the charter school agenda came in, that it was understood that if you would just reopen as a charter school, you would be greenlighted invited. If you want to reopen your neighborhood school, they're going to put you through a much harder course to do that.
And in 2006, Secretary of Education Margaret Spellings under George W. Bush announced $24 million in federal aid to Louisiana, but this was only for charter schools, not public schools. So what does the situation look like today, Gary? Because some of the politicians interviewed on the Sunday shows said, oh, our education system is better than ever. We have more young black men graduating from high school than ever.
Yes. Yeah, so in the last few years, at least it's stabilized some. There was a lawsuit filed on behalf of the special needs kids where the district, the state had to admit that, yes, they were failing the special needs kids. What you see happening a lot is cherry picking. Kip, not to single them out, because I think all the charter schools were doing this, they were saying, like, well, we don't want that child because they might lower our scores. You see that suspension rates were the highest in Orleans Parish of any place in the country because, like, let's get rid of this kid because he or she is hurting our scores. But, you know, finally in the last 2 or 3 years, the scores, for what it's worth, have been getting better. You see a higher graduation rate. I mean, from 48% to 60%, it's still a failing system, but at least it's going in the right direction. You're seeing a higher portion of kids, which is to say black kids, because the system is 90% or so African-American, going on to college. So there have finally in the last few years been stabilization. There has been some improvement. But, you know, I'm going to defer to Tabitha on this. I mean, these are just data points from the outside that indicate that the system is going in the right direction, though.
Tabitha, what are your thoughts?
I mean, the data points are just that, data points, because when you're passing tests, you're only passing tests because some of the piece-by-piece members that we work with don't know how to address an envelope. They don't, they're struggling in school. So it's just because you can graduate from a school that has set the standard at being able to pass tests and not necessarily being able to think critically or to learn skills that were taught before the storm, I think you could say the system now is probably failing more than ever before.
And so how are community groups organizing around this? You, again, are a piece-by-piece program manager. It's a program of the American Friends Service Committee.
Right. So what we're doing here, we predominantly focus around nonviolence work, but we're moving more into campaign and policy change here. We're trying to create change within communities in the way that the systems that have failed black and brown people, predominantly young black New Orleanians, on so many levels. So we just bought a house that we plan to open up as a community center, hopefully to provide classes and tutoring help, to have a community garden to provide food for those who can't afford food because of the horrible state of labor in New Orleans. We're just trying to make up for all of the things that the city, who is supposed to provide those things for us, has failed to do. A lot of organizing here has to do with anti-racism because, I mean, let's face it, most of this has been an act of pure racism. And there are groups like Rethink that organize specifically around education. There are the Vietnamese Association, so it's called VELA, that's recently tried to integrate with a Latino organization and African-American students out in the East where they're facing a lot of environmental racism and just a real lack of infrastructure. And these are just some of the things that young organizers are doing to combat, I guess, the oppression that's being placed upon them, predominantly in schools, but outside of schools and housing. A lot of the young people that we work with have trouble with housing. Some of them can live in the new mixed income housing. Others have had their houses torn down. So there's a lot of grassroots organizing, trying to get access to affordable housing, because what's called affordable housing really isn't affordable for most people who are making $7.25 an hour. So there's the Fight for 15 here, who's doing organizing to raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour, which has happened for city contractors, but it hasn't happened for fast food workers and hospitality workers, where most black New Orleans in the city predominantly work.
Tabitha Mustafa is a social justice activist based in New Orleans. She was just 13 when the levees broke. We're also joined by Gary Rivlin. He's out with a new book, Katrina After the Flood. We've got time for just a few calls. Let's hear from Tim in Santa Cruz. Hi, Tim. Thank you for holding. Oh, sorry. Did we lose Tim? Okay, let's try Nick in Watsonville. Hi, Nick.
Hi. Hello?
Hi, go ahead. You're on the air.
Okay, yeah, it's beginning to sound like a kind of a reserved ethnic cleansing. To me, the people who failed to evacuate kind of faced an attitude, and that was grassroots was right there. It's food, not bombs. And they were trying to be not even welcome there. At the same time, FEMA people were gorging themselves in tents. Nobody was feeding there. What's your take on the story? Tell on the story. That story I just said.
So you're talking about Food Not Bombs was evicted?
Well, they were the first ones there to feed the people who couldn't evacuate or failed to, and yet the FEMA people were they were in their tents just feeding themselves for a few days.
So you mean government officials working for FEMA?
Yeah.
Okay, Gary, do you know anything about that?
I don't know about that, but it was outside the convention center. You'd see the National Guard soldiers off on their own. They had enough water. They had enough food while you had all the people, 20,000, in the convention center suffering. The caller just used the term ethnic cleansing. Actually, Barney Frank's comment, the former congressman at the time, said it was ethnic cleansing through inaction. You know, there really was this sense of the push. To give a couple of quick examples, 54% of New Orleans were renters. There was never a plan to help renters. There was never a plan to make sure that there's affordable housing in this city that lost virtually all of its housing after Katrina. It just was never a priority. And even those who were beneficiaries of the Road Home program, which you mentioned earlier is the largest federal housing recovery program in U.S. history, was meant to help the working class, the middle class, making them whole up to $150,000 to rebuild. Well, the problem was they based it on not replacement value, not the cost of rebuilding, but on the appraised value of your home at the time of Katrina. Plaintiffs, African-American homeowners, say, well, that wasn't fair. Our homes, it costs the same for a contractor, costs the same for a roofer, but our homes are, say, worth half, according to the appraiser, according to the prices they sell for, than a white-owned home. And a federal judge 5 years after Katrina said, you know, you're right. This is a racially discriminatory program. It's benefiting white homeowners over black homeowners. White homeowners are getting much more than black homeowners, but it was too late. Mm. This $10 billion program, they had less than $150 million less. So, you know, why are there communities, why are there African-American communities in New Orleans that are 10 years after Katrina, only 50%, 60% back? Because of Road Home. Because there's, you know, the one great program that was going to help homeowners, black and white, help white homeowners, and it didn't help black homeowners to the same extent, and people didn't have enough money to rebuild.
You know, Gary, what, your final thoughts on this? We've got just a couple minutes left. I mean, you tell amazing stories in the book, and you know, I appreciate you kind of setting the record straight, because it seems like a lot of these politicians are trying to rewrite history about what actually happened and where we are today. So, what are you hoping actually comes from, you know, exposing how we actually got here and then where we're going, not just in New Orleans, but so many towns that are basically like a tale of two cities? I mean, we're dealing with this in San Francisco right now.
Right. So the thing that bothered me was the intentionality of this, that this was a deliberate plan that was largely successful. In New Orleans, you have a mayor, Mitch Landrieu, a pretty good mayor, but back in May, he said the recovery is behind us. He's taking a victory lap. I see it as, you know, the same as George Bush having mission accomplished. Like, what are you talking about? Half your city is still suffering. And so I really welcome the opportunity to say, like, hey, there's amazing stories. The city of New Orleans is back to a large extent, but let's look at the work that still needs to be done. Forget the violence problem and, you know, the struggles of a city where literally half the African-American men do not have a job. Let's talk about what's going on in the neighborhoods that, you know, half the city is still struggling 10 years after Katrina. If we're going to learn from these kind of disasters, let's use the worst disaster in modern U.S. history to learn. And the lessons they provide are not very encouraging.
Hmm. Tabitha, what are your thoughts on a young organizer who's working on these issues?
We could really use a lot of help. We definitely haven't recovered. The mayor has talked a lot about resilience. And if there's one word that I hate right now, it's the word resilience, because resilience implies that you take punch after punch and you come back, which is true. That is something that Black New Orleans and Black New Orleanians have been doing for quite some time. But we're trying to change the narrative right now to being resistant, actively fighting the oppression that's being impressed upon us right now. In our resistance, we're trying to get our voices heard, make sure that we're not trying to follow this Milton Friedman-esque plan of using the city as an opportunity. We talked a lot about, disaster capitalism, about capitalizing off of the trauma and natural disasters and man-made disasters, really, because I think there's a lot of talk in the media about this being, a natural disaster. In fact, it's not. A lot of it was negligence. There was a barge left in the industrial canal that actually slammed against the levees and broke part of the levees. So there's, a lot of people will say they heard a bomb or something like that. It really was just the barge hitting the levee. So negligence from the very beginning, the moment that they said the storm was coming, failure of the government to act in a timely manner are all things that we're working on organizing against right now. Stopping the assault on the Black body is the narrative that we're trying to preach at the moment.
And do you feel like this has really kind of created a new generation of young activists who really want to make things right and really use their voices?
Yeah, I mean, I think maybe there is a new generation, but I think if you look back to the civil rights movement, look at organizations like SNCC, it's always been the youth that have really led movements, and it really just took some older organizers to kind of look at them and say, you know what, you guys are right. We're going to try and follow the plan that you're setting forth, and that's why the young people that I work with kind of have the say in what we do, because they are the ones who are experiencing most of the trauma.
Tabitha Mustafa is a social justice activist in New Orleans. She was just 13 when the levees broke. And Gary Rivlin is an investigative journalist who's out with a new book, Katrina, After the Flood. Gary and Tabitha, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Rose.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. What does the Tenderloin look like through the eyes of youth who live there? On the next Your Call, we'll speak with organizers, artists, and kids who've documented life in the neighborhood. Equipped with cameras, 19 young people used photography to explore poverty, immigration, and public health. With a reputation for homelessness, drugs, and now an increasing number of tech companies, what do these images tell us about life in the Tenderloin and its future? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or to sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Laura Flynn produces the show. Malihe Razazan is senior producer. Matt Martin is executive producer. And Rosalie Atkinson is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Joe Burke is our studio engineer. Our theme music is performed and composed by Live Human. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.